Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
As you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, and we are here with a very special guest who practically wrote the book on Jane Eyre, which is the book we're going to talk about.
Nice.
We're with Karen Swallow Pryor, our old friend who's been on the podcast a time or two with us. Karen, we're so glad to have you back. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's great to be back together with you guys. It's been almost a year, I think. And what a year, right?
No kidding.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Right.
No kidding. Yeah. So last year you joined us for Frankenstein.
Right.
You were working on the edition that came out alongside this Jane Eyre edition, which has been out for 2 weeks now. I think March.
Yeah, 2 weeks. Wow. Yeah.
You were working on that. You were making notes while we were talking. Did it end up being helpful?
It absolutely ended up being helpful. It was really good to be able to do that, to have that fresh in my mind as I was working on it. And I guess I had already done Jane. I don't even remember. It's all a blur.
Yeah.
But yeah, now we're talking about Jane Eyre after the fact. So hopefully, as a result of this podcast, I won't have any regrets or won't have any like, oh, I should have said that or I got that wrong.
Need a second edition.
Yeah, exactly.
So the previous year, we did Sense and Sensibility. So you now have six of these editions out. Let's see if four, six?
I have four out and I'll be working this summer. So
okay.
We should be having that discussion right
now.
Yeah,
I know, right? So you did Heart of Darkness and Sense and Sensibility. Mm-hmm. And then you did Frankenstein and Jane Eyre. And then what are the next two? What did you say?
The next two are The Scarlet Letter and Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
And those will be out this time next year?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Lord,
I've thought about doing Tess before. Some people think that's a dark book, a very sad
darkness
book.
And I guess, oh, it's so dark.
It's so sad. There's
so
no
much
other interpretation. It's not like some people think that. There's,
well,
if you end this book thinking, wow, what a cheerful exploration of human existence.
What I meant was some people think it's dark to the extent that they don't want to read it.
Right.
So, but when has that ever stopped us on this podcast?
Not a single time.
Scarlet Letter is not exactly a walk in the park itself. So so that, I'm just curious if you have any previews you can give us on any future titles you're thinking about doing. How many of these do you want to do?
Well, it will be the series. I'm contracted to do six.
Okay.
So I'll do those will be the last two. And then I would love to do more, but I'm anxious also to, I have another, you know, book that I'm writing mind that I'm anxious to get started on, and that will take me a couple years, I'm sure. So.
Okay, you got many things to do. Okay, so Jane Eyre. This was a novel that was published under a pen name. So there's a couple things I want to talk about just by way of context for this book and as an entryway into our discussions over the next 8 weeks or whatever it is. It was published in October of 1847. And then the following year, the American edition was published. And there's a couple questions that I want to put to you, Karen, first. One is the pseudonym. And the basic question is, you know, why did she write under a pseudonym? Is it just that she didn't think she'd get a fair shake as a woman? And do we know why she chose the pseudonym Currer Bell?
Well, I'll start with the second question. So all of the Bronte sisters published works of poetry and novels under pseudonyms, and all of them chose gender-neutral but masculine-sounding first names that began with the same initial as their actual name. So Anne Bronte was Acton Bell, Charlotte was Currer, and who am I forgetting? But whatever. The other sister.
Emily,
right.
It's
what
Ellis.
Was Emily's?
Ellis Bell.
Yes. Yeah. So they weren't really, I don't think Currer was an actual first name, but I don't think that there is a lot of documentation about why they chose pseudonyms, but certainly writing, and especially writing novels, was not a feminine task. And these were the daughters of a clergyman, and they lived rather obscure, sort of anonymous lives, which they relished. None of the Bronte sisters really wanted to be well-known or celebrated or famous. And so I think it was really, it was a combination. They wanted the anonymity, but they also wanted a better chance of being published by going under at least, you know, gender neutral names. We couldn't really argue that Kerr was that Charlotte was really pretending to be a man, because the first edition was had the title, it was Jane Eyre, an autobiography. So
okay,
it was like a red herring. I mean, nobody could know who it was or whether it was male or female or.
So you think they were trying to preserve in some way the reputation of their father? They didn't, just in case people took issue with things that were in their books?
I don't think it was so much that as just sort of like the family and themselves. I mean, people, this was before or maybe during the beginning of what we would call celebrity culture. People write and seek to be published because they wanted to be celebrities. They wrote and sought to be published because they were writers and they loved the craft. And, you know, most people weren't going to really, I mean, there were some celebrity writers at the time, but certainly the likes of the Bronte sisters weren't going to ever dream that they would be that.
So when did it then initially become, when did Charlotte Bronte's name get stamped on the cover?
Oh, that is a good question that I don't know if I know the answer to, but I do want to explain it, that when we're talking about writers using pseudonyms and being anonymous, that's like in the wider public. It's not like oftentimes they're close circle of friends and other people would know who the writers were. And so the secret wasn't very, it wasn't like a big secret that the literary circles would know, but it would just be the wider world that didn't know. And I don't know, I would have to look up when her name came out. But if that makes sense, it's like an open secret or something like that might describe the way these.
So the very important follow-up question is, what is the pseudonym that you are using for the novels and things like that that you don't want us to know that you are writing?
Oh, I wish I could claim to be a creative writer. I've got a couple short stories going, but I don't know if I'll ever, yeah, I don't know. Those will be probably years in the making.
What is J.K. Rowling's Robert Galbraith, I think is, yeah. Even the most famous, one of the most famous writers in the world has a pseudonym, which feels like a game. Just feels like she wanted to, you know.
And Stephen King, you know, they're the Bachman books that he published long ago under a pseudonym. He was already famous, so I don't know why he did that.
Maybe he wanted to know if people would buy the books.
Yeah.
Despite his, you know, that it wouldn't just be relying on his fame. Yeah. Okay, so this book is very influential. You talk about it in the introduction, so some of what we may talk about for the next few minutes might be a little bit of a rehash for people who, you know, got their copy and immediately, you know, tucked into the introduction. I want to talk about genre a little bit, and I want to talk about the role that this book played in the history of the novel. Even in On Reading Well, you write about the history of the novel a fair bit and what some of the earliest novels were and what they were known for and how the form evolved. So where does Jane Eyre show up on the continuum of the novel's evolution? It was written in 1847, well, published in 1847. So it's a relatively early, still relatively early in the form of the novel. And its reputation would you say it just continues to grow? It's still considered one of the greatest novels ever written in English. And over the course of the next few weeks, hopefully we'll get at why is it that its reputation has been preserved? Why do people still love it as much as they do? Why did Karen Swallow Pryor do a new edition of it? So within the context of the novel, though, just in this longer continuum, what role does this novel play and how did it influence the form in its time?
Yeah. So there are a few different sort of strains that feed into the novel, into this novel, and in particular, then what we would call the Victorian novel, which I think is where the novel reached its sort of artistic zenith. Although, I mean, maybe plateau, because it's still good, I think. So there's sort of the comic strain that we get from Henry Fielding in the 18th century, like the history of Tom Jones. It's comic, satiric. We see that in Jane Austen at the beginning of, you know, of the 19th century. She's writing satire. And then there's the sentimental strain, the sort of, you know, romantic sentimental strain involving a love story or, you know, someone who's passionate and pursued or oppressed in some way. And those two movements or impulses sort of work against one another. And then, of course, there is a third strain, which is sort of the disreputable body history of the novel, which is all about, you know, tales of amorous intrigue that are naughty and not very moral. So all of those three kind of converge in the earliest novels represent one or the other, a combination. And in Jane Eyre, I think we see them all come together. We see, you know, we see the earnest, passionate heroine. We have the strain of romanticism that preceded the Victorian age. And we have the love story. We have the gothic. We have everything. And I think that's what makes Jane Eyre one of the best early novels that there is, because she sort of, you know, culminates a lot of those separate movements, where the earlier novels tend to be more an extreme version of either of those streams.
There's a couple different genres that have already, you mentioned gothic, and we just did Rebecca on the podcast, and so we're going to have plenty of time to discuss some of the comparisons between those two books. But this is also, you know, if you go to Wikipedia for Jane Eyre, the thing it mentions first is the idea of a bildungsroman. Now, the first question is that how you pronounce that word? That was how my college professor pronounced it. The second question is, can you define that and then tell us kind of where Jane Eyre fits in the continuum of that specific genre of novel as well?
Yeah, and the pronunciation is pretty good. I mean, it's a German word, bildungsroman, and so it comes from the tradition of German novels, which also has its own kind of history, particularly in the Romantic movement. You know, my field is English literature, so I know most about that, but Romanticism really came to England through Germany. So the Bildungsroman is the word that refers to a novel. It's the same word, like because novels come from romances. And so roman is that same word. And building just means building or development. So Jane Eyre is also a novel of development. You know, it carries, you know, it takes a young person and carries her through as her life develops into maturity. And so it's a wonderful example of that. And that's really what the novel as a form and a genre became, largely because of Jane Eyre, later Dickens and other writers.
So was that genre, that form, not as popular? I mean, was this the book that made it popular? English?
Yeah, I would say so, yes.
So what
I mean, it was one of the leading contributors. I mean, they all were sort of, you know, all of these great Victorian novelists, Eliot, Thackeray, Dickens, Bronte, all of the Brontes, they were writing, you know, in very close proximity to one another. So these sorts of things end up sort of being in the air, kind of.
So other than like the themes of coming of age and a life being built, are there any formal characteristics of a bildungsroman that we should look out for? Any recurring, not just formal flourishes, mm-hmm. but any kind of structural mm-hmm. things or motifs or archetypes that tend to show up a lot that either Jane Eyre maybe invented or helped grow, or whatever word you want to use.
Yeah. I do think that we need to see the character developing from a young age through early adulthood. So it's not just a smaller slice of life. The other thing is, I don't think this is necessary, but what you'll often find is that it isn't told in first person narration. There may be exceptions to that. Those would really be the only one. And the focus on that novel. So I don't think even something like Vanity Fair would be a bildungsroman, even though there are characters in it who go through that. The bildungsroman really focuses on one character. It's very unified in that sense.
Mm. What are some of the other books that you would say most?
Great Expectations, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man later on by James Joyce. A lot of American stuff, you know, like Catcher in the Rye, probably. How far does that go into his, maybe?
To Kill a Mockingbird? Is it they have to get actually older?
I think the novel is so concerned with other characters and their stories that I don't know that it really focuses enough on Scout.
What about Huckleberry Finn? Or does it have to go further into their life?
Not Huckleberry Finn.
Okay.
Yeah, it really, like, it's a novel of development over that, a larger course of life, I guess. Yeah, this is a good question, David. It really got me thinking.
Okay. I mean, the Dickens ones, of course. Well, one of the things that a lot of those books have in common with Jane Eyre is how large they are. So are most of the Buildings Roman novels, you know, doorstop books?
I think most of them are, but again, like even something like Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man is a little bit shorter, but it's the Victorian novels that tend to be like this.
It's not the Building of Roman.
It's the Victorian. And keep in mind, so that's not just coincidence. I mean, the readership, the public readership of people who were reading, just reading in general, was at its, you know, had really grown during the Victorian age. The technology was available to make printing much easier and more widely accessible. And so these books like Dickens would be printed usually in a serial publication first, and then they were put into novels. That wasn't true of Jane Eyre, but it was published in, like, you know, often, as was often the case with Frankenstein as well, three volumes. So there was less to do, right? I mean, people were reading. They were reading a lot. Printing was becoming cheaper and easier to distribute. And so these long stories were suitable to the times.
Yeah, people weren't sitting around watching 12 hours of TV in 3 days.
Or scrolling Twitter, you know?
Yeah, true. Boys, those must have been the days. Other than like the typhus and stuff. So Heidi, I mentioned that if you go to Wikipedia, it says, you know, this is a Buildings Roman novel. But we've also talked about how this is a Gothic novel. And I'm curious, when you think about this novel, I'm not saying it has to be one or the other, but when you think about this novel, do you think of it like intuitively in your gut as a Gothic novel or a Buildings Roman first? Like, what's your first thought about what this is? I'm not saying you can't have a Gothic Buildings Roman. But
Yeah. Well, you almost, I mean, in the two that we will read on the podcast in a row, Rebecca and then now Jane Eyre, they both are both of those there. Mm. And I think that one of the reasons why the Gothic genre lends itself to that kind of intense character development internally and externally is because all Buildings Roman novels also have at their core a person facing extraordinary circumstances and then having to overcome internally and externally. And obviously the intensity of a Gothic novel and the extreme circumstances, you know, we joke about that, right? That our Byronic hero and our fires and floods and insanity and incest and all the things that go into these kind of larger than life kind of Gothic circumstances in a novel kind of lends itself to a character going through some kind of intense emotional crisis and emerging on the other side. And so I think that's kind of a natural way to take the Gothic novel and elevate it above its elements and make it something truly literary and truly human.
So when did you first encounter this novel? When did you first learn to love it?
I read Jane Eyre. I don't even remember the first time I read it. I don't know. Karen, do you remember the first time you read Jane Eyre? I just remember it being part of the furniture of my mind as a young woman.
It's actually the same here. The only reason why I sort of remember it is because I still have my high school copy of it with like my handwriting in it. So
I
have that, but I don't remember it the first time reading it the way I remember Tess of the D'Urbervilles, for example, or even Pride and Prejudice. So I don't. Yeah, I agree with you. It's just been in the furniture of my mind for so long.
How many times have either of you read this?
I couldn't count that, probably 20 times, maybe. a lot of times. So.
Yeah. I mean, I teach it almost every time I teach the English mm-hmm. novel, you know, and then, so I want to say 10 or 15 times, and every time is not like a thorough
right
reading
right,
cover yeah. to cover, but yeah. So yeah, 15 maybe.
Hmm. I've read it. Yeah. This might only be like the third or the fourth time. So compared to you all, I'm just like.
But please don't ask me like any really detailed questions. Like
on page 77.
That's right. Yes, can't be expected to close read this novel.
So I have had an interesting experience reading this.
Go on.
Because I like it more this time than I did. I read it in college. I think I read it in like just a Victorian class with a bunch of other novels, and I remember the workload. You know, when you read things as an assignment and it's in school and there's so much to read and so much to write and all that, I think that detracted from it. And then I read it again later and I've enjoyed it more this time, and I don't know if it's because I'm just increasingly more familiar with it. And it's not that I didn't like it, it was more like I appreciated it and it wasn't like what Tim likes to call a heart book, right? But I'm finding it like it's more of a page turner than I remembered it being. And that might just be because, you know, it was homework, or at least the first time I read it, it was homework. Also, I do want to say, Karen, the new edition is very nice. It's very readable.
It's beautiful.
The margins are nice.
The introduction is awesome. Like really helpful.
I'm so glad.
The paper is nice. It feels good in your hands. Mm-hmm. The notes are helpful. The margins are good. The kerning and the typography is good.
Well, I do want to say that, let's see how. So this is an entirely new kind of thing that my publisher is doing. I mean, if you know Lifeway and B&H, they basically publish Sunday school material, right? So this is not. So I mean, they do more than that,
right,
but
right.
This is a new idea for them. It's new for me, and I have a great hand in the design. I'm not a designer, but I've been given a lot of leeway, and so for these two, the last two, they didn't have. We changed the margins and the font, and I'm so pleased, so much more pleased with how it came out, because they weren't the margins weren't justified on both sides for the previous mm-hmm. two editions, mm-hmm. and it just looked different. So we're improving, you know, it's a process.
Yeah, so, there's a great debate in the design world about the justification thing.
Oh, really?
Because it didn't used to be that way. And so a lot of people are like, if you want your books to look older, you shouldn't justify. I think it might be Alan Jacobs, who is very against justification, just not as a theological
right.
term, but as
right,
a,
right.
I don't want to comment on, you know, Alan Jacobs' theology publicly. I feel like that would be a poor taste, a mistake. Yes. So one of the things I like about it is a lot of times the books that you read in college, they're the Norton ones and the fonts are small and the lines
tiny,
are tight.
Tiny, yes.
And the pages are sometimes gray and sometimes they're used, so they're worn, or you try to get the cheap ones, so you get a mass market. And that mm-hmm. all that stuff really does influence your experience reading a book. And this has been just the reading experience of this has been very pleasant. So if you don't have a copy of this edition, Heidi and I am speaking for someone. Heidi and I definitely think you should get this because it's
for sure.
It's really good.
10 out of 10.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm glad we're spending a little time talking about, I mean, not just because it's mine, but talking about a physical book because, well, you know, I mean, you have a bookstore, you care yeah. about these things, right? Yeah. But first of all, we care about them. I do think that living in the digital age, people are kind of yearning for more mm-hmm. of this physical experience. And so I do think, you know, just holding a book, having thick paper and nice font. I first, you know, first thought the font in these books were, I think it was bigger in the other. We had to make it smaller for Jane Eyre because it's already so big.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, personally, I prefer smaller books. Maybe because I'm used to them in smaller print, but this is growing on me. So I think you found a good medium.
I'm
just glad to hear it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think you found a good medium for the font between what you had before, the font, mm-hmm. the layout, and what you have here. So, bravo to the whole B&H team and you for making it work.
Thank you.
And they look good on the shelves together, all the different editions.
Right, right, right.
It's very satisfying to look at that, just all in a row.
Picking all the final colors was really hard. We finally decided.
So you're going to have to do, I mean, you're going to have to do more than six is just what we're saying in the long run.
Maybe.
Yeah, no pressure. Okay, so one of the things that you talk about in the introduction that I think is a good way to jump into our discussion of the novel itself, the chapters that we talked about for this week, which was chapters 1 through 5, is this idea of the voice of this character, of this narrator. Because it, from the get-go, it's so specific. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of a term that writers like to use a lot, but it's unique. It feels lived in, you know, it feels very real. And one of the things that I think we should talk about is how Bronte achieves that, and how, mm-hmm. you know, how does she helps us to get to know this character, you know, from the get-go, as I said, from the first line, it feels unique and specific. I'd love to hear from the two of you how you feel like she achieves that. Heidi, I'm going to turn to you first, because then if you say something wrong, Karen can correct you. I'm just kidding.
Perfect.
Then, yes. Then, but just to give you, you know, you haven't had enough of the airtime yet. It's basically what I'm trying to say. So for you, when you think about the voice of this character and you think about the book before you are reading it again, there's kind of two ways that I'd like to go at this, because we have this sort of lasting impression of this character and her voice. And then mm-hmm. we also have the specifics of close reading it again this time. And does that difference make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, as you've read this book 20 times or whatever you said it was, there's an impression that's gone with you over the years. And I'd love to look at both of those things. So for you, what is that impression of this? Like, what stands out about this character that stuck with you over the years of reading this, even before you read Karen's introduction and so forth?
Right. Whenever I think of Jane Eyre, I get a very specific image in my head, and it's been in my mind every single time I've read or thought about this novel. And it is Jane in Thornfield, which we haven't gotten to on the podcast yet, so I'm not going to give any spoilers here. But there's an image of her walking in front of windows, gazing off into the moors, into the wild, into the...
I think you just described a gothic novel.
Right. And she's... And this is described in the novel. She's just pacing these windows looking out. And that image is so compelling to me. And in some sense captures everything that I love about Jane and this novel. This idea of this woman who is continually gazing off into the horizon because of her longing to be a part of something beyond herself, and yet fully accepting her limits. And that she's internally battling the fact that she can't get out there, but she is completely accepting of those limits herself. And there's this intense battle within her. We see that in the first 5 chapters that we've read up till now, that her voice is characterized by an assertion of self and yet an acceptance of limits, and the full engagement in the tension between those things, and who she becomes as a result of that. So she is a fighter, right? We know that from the very beginning, but she has this incredibly strong moral center and desire to be good. And that characterizes her from the very first pages of the novel all the way to the end. And that stays consistent throughout. And I'm so endeared to that. And I feel like that a lot of the time. And I love the fact that Jane is, I love that. She's just constantly pacing and looking out the window. And that's kind of the image that I have. And you see that from the very beginning of the novel. I mean, really, I think the first paragraph of the novel, you have this consistent image of who this young woman is as a child, who she was as a child, and it kind of guides through who she becomes.
Well, it's interesting that the first line of chapter 1 is about walking.
Yep. And the limits, right? Yeah. There's no possibility of a walk that day. So anyway, Karen.
Yeah, jump in whenever you want, Karen.
Yeah, no. And again, it's helpful, I guess, to think, well, I can't help but think about the historical place of a book like mm-hmm. this. So, as I said before, a lot of the earlier novels, they were either sort of satirical or comic, or they were over the top, romantic or gothic, and often not first person. I mean, there were first person novels before this, but what Bronte does is she just presents a first person narrator who sounds realistic. She's earnest. She's sincere. She's, you know, to use a term that's popular today, authentic. This is actually what Virginia Woolf noted, you know, at the end of the century in writing about female novelists and writers. I mean, she says that what Jane Eyre accomplishes is entirely in the voice of the narrator. And so this is something that was recognized, you know, even, you know, shortly after the time, that this was its strength. And again, that's something we might take for granted today because yeah. we're many, many novels later. This is what people do. But this is quite a feat at this time, even to the point, as I mentioned in the introduction, that well, it's partly because it said the subtitle was an autobiography, but people thought that this was Charlotte Bronte speaking about her life and that she was Jane Eyre because the voice seemed so realistic.
Go ahead, Addie.
Yeah, I think I really like that. And I think contextualizing the novel always within its own world is important, like you're saying, Karen, because I mean, now you can go down to like the grocery store and buy novels by women narrators talking about their inner lives, right? Like that's, they're a dime a dozen. There's few of them that are really, really good, but this is something, especially within the current publishing world, the idea of marginalized narrator presenting an experience of the world is now, I mean, that's like in fashion now. Everybody wants to do that.
Right.
Like you can't, the risk now would be writing from a different perspective than that, right? That wasn't the case then. In fact, she was actively squelched by other published writers at the time. Robert Southey told her, you know, get back in the kitchen, right? And instead she took this enormous risk by not only writing from a female narrator, but writing from the perspective of a female narrator who wants more than the world is giving her.
Right.
And is characterized by that throughout the entire novel. That's an enormous risk for a woman novelist to take in writing from the perspective of a woman. And Jane is so fully human with her weaknesses as well as her glories that it is, as you're saying, a remarkable achievement, no matter what time it was written in, but particularly for its own time.
Right. Really, I mean, it was groundbreaking in some ways. So
what were the things that she was doing specifically? Can you point to a passage or some examples of the kind of things that she was, I mean, you said first person, but how do we see her being able to get to that specificity and that authenticness? And what does she do that makes it so real that people thought it was Charlotte Bronte's, you know? And as you said, we've all read, you know, many of these sort of narrators now. Some of the tools, you know, that an author would use to create that sort of a narrator, maybe we've sort of adapted to them. We've learned to just sort of accept them. But one thing that I'm interested in is like, what are some of the specific things she was doing that nobody had done before that maybe we're used to it now? Because we've, you know, on this show, people who would listen to this show read a lot of books, you know, maybe they've read, you know, I just read a Penelope Fitzgerald novel with this wonderful first person female narrator who was up against it and kind of carve her life out for herself. And there's all these things that she does that I was like, I wonder where she got that from. And now I'm wondering if she got it from Charlotte Bronte. Or I just listened to the New York Times did an amazing interview with Kazuo Ishiguro about his new novel. And in the interview, in the profile, he basically says his favorite book is Jane Eyre. And half the time he reads one of his manuscripts and realizes, oh, I just stole that directly from Jane Eyre. So a lot of this stuff has been passed on. But what was she doing at the time that, you know, the 1850s version of Heidi White would never have seen before?
I think one thing that I would say is that, you know, again, I'm studying this in context. We have a famous first person narrator in Samuel Richardson's Pamela from the century before. And what Richardson has Pamela doing as she's writing letters in this epistolary novel, and what she's doing is called writing to the moment. Like she's actually right. She's like writing to her parents. She's saying, "Oh no, my master's knocking at the door. I've got to put my letter away." And it's just, I mean, it was what he did was groundbreaking, but it was also it just doesn't really work. It's not that realistic. But what we have in Jane Eyre is we have this earnest, sincere person, you know, bearing her soul and her feelings, but she's also doing it in a reflective way. Like, you know, we get to the end and we realize that she, without a spoiler, you know, that she's reflecting back on what has happened. So she's able to, you know, sort of return us with her to her childhood experiences, but she's also doing this with some reflection. I mean, I guess a passage that I would look at would be, Heidi already mentioned, I mean, the first line, the opening line, there was no possibility of taking a walk that day. We had been wandering indeed in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning, but since dinner, Mrs. Reed, when there was no company, dined early. The cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so somber and a rain so penetrating that further outdoor exercise was now out of the question. Like, we are in that moment, but there's also, there's a reflectiveness there. This isn't like I don't know how old she is here, 6 or 5 or 7 or something like that. It's not written in the voice of a young child, even though she's putting us there. I was glad of it. I never liked long walks, especially on chilly afternoons. Dreadful to me was the coming home in the raw twilight with nipped fingers and toes and a heart saddened by the chidings of Bessie, the nurse, and humbled by the consciousness of my physical inferiority to Eliza John and Georgiana Reed. I mean, there's just so much there that is both, you know, that child's soul and also a maturer woman looking back and understanding what was happening in that interior life. It's magnificent.
So one of the things I noticed that you can't help but notice if you just look at a page is there's a lot of asides, you know, the parentheticals, mm-hmm. things between, mm-hmm. at least in your edition, that are M dashes. I don't know if they used M dashes in 1847, but those asides also seem to like help produce the uniqueness of her voice. There's almost like as if to say, oh, you might want to know this, or.
Right. Like this self-commentary, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, That's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that done often at the time? Now you read something like that and probably an editor would say, maybe that, does that really need to be there?
That is familiar. I think there was that tendency existed already to just elaborate and comment. And
it's
maybe
almost
over
stream of consciousness, like a precursor to stream of consciousness almost.
Yeah. Yeah. In some ways it is. Yeah.
Heidi, do you have any passages that for you are examples of the voice?
I think the tension between Jane's desire for self-knowledge that will eventually lead her to a true assertion of the self, but the seeds of that we find in Jane the child in these first 5 chapters that we read. Say the first paragraph of chapter 2, I think, is pretty compelling and gives you a lot about Jane. It says, I resisted all the way.
So
a new thing for me.
It's on page 40, right?
On page 40 in our edition, yeah.
Yeah.
I resisted all the way, a new thing for me, and a circumstance which greatly strengthened the bad opinion Bessie and Miss Abbott were disposed to entertain of me. The fact is, I was a trifle beside myself, or rather, out of myself, as the French would say. I was conscious that a moment's mutiny had already rendered me liable to strange penalties, and like any other rebel slave, I felt resolved in my desperation to go all lengths. This inner kernel of resistance to injustice that is already characterizing our narrator here, without any self-knowledge, at this point. She's a child. So here's what she knows. John was beating me. I didn't deserve it. And I resisted, and I'm going to continue to resist. And yet at the same time, there's just this sense of forlorn loss, even in this paragraph, of wanting to please and not being able to, and understanding that that's going to create for her something that is bigger than her and bigger even than the situation. She's about this when she goes and gets locked in the Red Room, which is an iconic literary scene and brilliantly written. So I like this paragraph a lot because it tells you so much about Jane. It tells you she even as a child, she had the potential to be self-aware, the potential for self-knowledge, a driving towards that, and a deep sense of resistance to injustice and knowledge that that is going to cost her something and she's willing to pay it.
Is that what makes her capable of, well, I mean, I'm trying to think of how to ask a question without giving anything away.
But it gives her this capacity for, a capacity to ignite, in a sense, our pity, but that's not what she's going for, right? She's not justifying herself. The tone of this of her, as Karen said, she's looking back and reflecting on her life and telling us something for some reason, right? And we can tell that from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But she's not justifying herself. In fact, she even condemns her own self-indulgent self-justification later on when she's at school. And I can't remember if we read that for this reading or not. I don't think we did. Her conversation with Helen. Anyway, there's a conversation coming up, and this isn't too big of a spoiler, in which Jane shares her sad childhood experiences with a classmate at Lowood School. And the classmate essentially lets Jane know, you're just being kind of self-indulgent here and self-justifying. And Jane receives that. So what we have, that she's constantly on this movement forward, but she doesn't have the resources at this time in her life in order to gain any wisdom. She's just kind of enduring her abusive circumstances as best she can and making many mistakes, and then also setting herself up to, as you said, David, I like the word capacity. We see in these early chapters that Jane's inner life is developing a capacity to suffer, a capacity to endure, a capacity to not always be right. Like, we don't have in this novel just this poor, perfect Cinderella virtuous figure who's always right about everything. Like, she's fully human in every way, and in terms of her own weaknesses and darkness, as well as her capacity for goodness and virtue. And both of those things kind of characterize her general journey here. But I like that paragraph I read, because it tells us she's resistant, but she's not resistant to goodness. She's resistant to injustice. And she's trying to find her way toward goodness with nobody to teach her about it.
Mm. Go ahead, Karen.
I think another quality that comes out in her voice and in her personality, because this is another contribution that the novel makes, is just presenting someone who has a personality, like a strong personality. And if we had to reduce, describe, I don't know which anagram, how do you say that? Anagram. I don't even know.
Enneagram.
Enneagram. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a millennial, so I don't know. But I'm sure somebody could fit Jane Eyre into one of those. But in the terms of her times, I mean, her overriding personality characteristic is passion. Like, she just mm-hmm. has a passionate nature. And we see her contesting this even, in chapter 4, where Mrs. Reed calls her deceptive, and Jane says, deceit is not my fault. And then Mrs. Reed says, but you are passionate, Jane. She seeks justice, but she's also passionate about it. Yeah. And then, her passion comes out in so many other ways as well. But this voice that she has and this sense of herself, I think early on is also displayed so wonderfully when Reverend Brocklehurst comes before her in chapter 4, and has this sort of submits her to this sort of catechism, right? Of, mm-hmm. How she's read the Bible and what book
Do
she
you
likes.
Like it?
And yeah. And then, and she says, that she, in order to avoid going to hell, she must not die, I guess.
Yeah. stay in good health.
stay in good health. So there's this, we see so many qualities in this scene that she doesn't fit into the box. And part of that is because she just hasn't been trained and tutored into how to fit the box, right? The books of the Bible she's supposed to like. She's not trying to say the wrong answer. She's giving the honest answer that she has to her understanding of hell and what books of the Bible she likes. And she's actually being honest. And then we also see that in her honesty, she has a flair for the dark. Her favorite books are Revelation and Daniel and Genesis and Samuel and a little bit of Exodus. I mean, she knows more of her Bible than any of the other characters later on proved to know, just and I guess she's 10 at this point when the novel opens. I said younger earlier, but there's just much that's shown about her in these opening scenes.
I love the scene where Mrs. Reed, I love where you mentioned that she says, you're deceitful, and Jane's like, of all the things that I am, deceitful is not one of them. Right. And then Mrs. Reed's like, okay, fine, you're passionate. And as if to say that, like, passion is just a variation on deceitfulness. So she does kind of know herself a little bit, even at this age. But Would you agree that this is a book, at least in part, about her learning to harness those passions or direct those passions appropriately, even as her passions are what makes her interesting?
I think that's the biggest part of the Buildings Roman here is, you know, she has this nature that is passionate. And by the way, in the 18th and 19th century, that there was this idea of like the ruling passion and nature with a capital N, that everyone has a nature and hers is her passion. And she does have to, that is really, you know, she has her passion and she also has this desire to be loved, not just romantic love, although that's obviously part of it, but she wants to be loved. And so she has to express those things appropriately.
Heidi, what were you going to say?
Yeah. Well, and now if we, you know, in modern times, if we say somebody is passionate, we generally mean that as a compliment. That's, you know, you're mm-hmm. so full of passion. You're passionate about whatever. And that was definitely not the case in the medieval time. If you call someone passionate in the medieval, high medieval ages, you're just essentially condemning them to hell, right? To be led by the passions, meaning the vices. That's what that meant. But where we're at now with Jane Eyre, the connotation of the word passion is not largely positive. It would have been saying exactly what Karen just said. You do not fit the mold. You are not a womanly child. You are not feminine enough. You're not submissive enough. You're led by anger and rage and desire. And so the idea of a passion being ruled and brought into submission to goodness is the journey of Jane, but that wouldn't have been intended as a compliment by someone calling her passionate. And it did not mean it's a lesser with her. When Aunt Reed says, but you're passionate, Jane, she's not being kind. Mm-hmm. And she's not letting her off the hook for deceit.
Right,
she's
right,
saying,
yeah.
You are a bad child.
One of the things I was thinking about is to what extent the narrator looking back on herself as a child would agree with the assessment that she was a bad child. There was a specific line in chapter 4. It's right around the passage where she says, he says, what as hell can you tell me that? And she says, a pit full of fire. And he says, and should you like to fall into that pit and to be burning there forever? And she says, no, sir. And he says, what must you do to avoid it? And then she says, ultimately, she says, I must keep in good health and not die. But what made me think about this is the question, or is the phrasing between that. It says, I deliberated a moment. My answer, when it did come, was objectionable. And you could read that as if to say, it was objectionable to the person she was talking to. But it also could just be that the narrator here is, as an adult, is making a statement of fact. She said something that is just fundamentally objectionable. Now, I may be reading into that a little bit, but it led me to the question, to what degree does she look back? Is she looking back at herself and assessing that maybe she wasn't such a great kid as maybe she thought in the moment? So how do you read that? Does older Jane Eyre looking back at herself as a child, look at herself and say, no, I had some problems? Or do you think she just looks back at herself and says, I was sorely oppressed and I was valiantly standing up against my oppressors, and like looked at herself as like that there's a virtue in this small child?
I think that's a really, really good question and an important interpretive question for the novel. What we do see a lot of, what you said earlier, Dave, what you pointed out earlier, David, parentheticals, right? There's a lot of interpretation from the narrator, Jane, on herself as a child and on the circumstances of her life. In a charitable sense, she even talks about, she makes a couple comments about how Aunt Reed really didn't know how to talk to her, if she had been more open-natured, if she had been more thankful, if she'd been more grateful, if she'd been prettier. Another big risk, by the way, a bold move on the part of Charlotte Bronte to write a narrator who is not pretty. And she did that intentionally on purpose. Like that was a major part of the whole point, right? I'm not writing an extraordinarily beautiful or talented person. I'm writing an ordinary person encountering extraordinary circumstances and becoming an extraordinary person through that, right? But we don't have, you know, the final reveal as of, I don't know, Oliver Twist actually was just like a rich guy in disguise. Sorry about the spoiler, but we don't have that in this novel. Right. So that's.
Well, now no one has to read that. So
I know. Well, you should though. You should read it. So my apologies, but it's that that's not what's happening here. I know. So anyway, the point is that she's charitably looking back on herself, but not only herself, but the people who were her tormentors, and trying to charitably explain to the reader, these were the circumstances of my childhood. And she interprets that in a very charitable way for us, not only of herself. She doesn't justify herself, but she tries to be charitable about herself. She doesn't demonize Aunt Reed, but she tells her us exactly what Aunt Reed did, and then says, but also consider the fact that I never showed any affection for this woman. And, you know, so she's looking back with some wisdom and some perspective that is intentionally charitable towards the beginning of her life.
This isn't about to devolve into the empathy, sympathy debate that was on Twitter recently, was it? Is it?
Oh, I would really rather not do that.
Let's just say for the sake of our discussion, they're similar enough that I think they, they are central to this novel.
Notions of empathy and sympathy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, empathy and sympathy, you know, for older Jane looking back on herself and also on looking back at these other people in her life, as Heidi said, I think that's very important. You know, and one thing to look for again, without giving spoilers, is, you know, just some of the thoughts and even the vows that Jane makes as a young girl are things she has to go back and revisit. And we want to see how she, you know, how she develops, because she is going to develop, and how she learns and grows and matures.
So as readers, how do you think that Jane Eyre, the narrator, looking back on her childhood, wants us to feel about these adults in her life? When you read Dickens and you read some of the characters that he has dealing with small children, you know, there's no question about how we're supposed to feel about, I don't know, Uriah Heep or someone. Now, maybe these characters aren't as awful as some of the Dickensian, you know, villains. But do you think that, does this narrator, is she asking us to look at them with any measure of empathy or sympathy for what they were having to deal with in their own lives? Is that what you're saying? How does the narrator want us to be looking at those characters?
Well, I think that we, you know, it's hard to answer that question without pretending we don't have the knowledge that comes later. But this is one of the things I love about what Bronte does. I mean, we will find out the futures of these characters in these opening scenes, and what Bronte does with those characters and how those characters develop and how their lives turn out helps us to interpret to understand how we're supposed to interpret them now.
So you're saying, let's ask this question again later.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I'm sort of answering it now. I guess we have to revisit it later.
Something to keep in mind. Yeah, Heidi, what were you going to say?
I do think that empathy and sympathy are crucial. I think that she is trying to display charity here. And she doesn't, you know, deceit is not her fault. And so she's not going to deceitfully cover up her childhood. She's trying to write a true and tell a true story,
right?
But tell a true story from a posture of forgiveness. And that, I think, comes through even in just reading the early chapters.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to make sure we get to at least touch on some of the characters that get introduced at Lowood School.
Yeah, that was
that's right. Yeah.
I was going to say, we need to talk about chapter five before we go.
Yeah. You know, and these characters, you know, these scenes and characters develop into the reading for next time. But I think one of the best ways that Bronte assists us in how to interpret Jane and other characters is through the comparison, through the contrast of the later characters. So we get, you know, Helen Burns, who is just one of the most wonderful characters in the novel. And I want to make sure I don't say too much, but we do get introduced to her.
Should we have a discussion about whether we should just be okay with giving away things?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't remember what the rules of the game are.
We'll follow your lead on that, David.
Yep. We'll get a sense, I think, of how many people have read this book. We should actually put a poll up on the page of how many people have read it. And if like the majority have read it, let's just say, you know, it's an old book that most of you have read. So if you haven't read it yet, then, you know, on Facebook.
I can say what I want to say about Helen anyway, without getting, you know, just the little bit that we have. And that's simply that, you know, she is a stoic girl compared to Jane's passion. She is rational. I mean, she's reading Samuel Johnson. She's very matter of fact on page 103 when she's describing what happens at the school and that, you know, her mother is dead. She's just very accepting of her lot in life, which contrasts sharply with the way that Heidi was describing Jane at the beginning, you know, someone who is looking out the windows at the wild moors and wanting to escape. You know, she wants something more. She accepts the limitations of her life, but she still wants something more. Helen is very stoic and, you know, and her character will be developed further, but that's something just to keep an eye on, is how one character compares to another. And that helps us to interpret, you know, character interprets character, I guess, is the way of saying it.
I do love that she's reading Samuel Johnson, though. Says a lot about a 13-year-old.
I do, too.
Even in 1847. So we have, as far as the characters go here, we've got Helen, and then we've got this roster of teachers, Miss Temple, who Helen says is very good and clever. She's above the rest because she knows far more than they do. And then we've got the French teacher, Miss Pierrot, and then Miss Statchard. These names are great, by the way. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I think I addressed this in the reflection questions at some point. The names of the places and the characters throughout this novel, there probably are some exceptions, but there are very few, are symbolic, allegorical, connotative. I mean, so if Mr. Brocklehurst sounds terrible, because he is terrible, and if Miss Temple sounds holy and sacred and good, it's because she is. So,
has there ever been a great book that didn't have great names?
Good question.
I was thinking about this the other day. Like, is that a prerequisite? Like, could a book last and persevere? It seems like a silly question. And at first I put it out of my head, and then I was driving and I thought, maybe that's actually not such a dumb question.
You know what? This is the thing I always say about Russian novels. I would love, I say I'm a purist, and then I'm going to say this and I'm going to lose all my purist creds. Russian novels would be 100 times easier for me if the only change they made was to replace the names with like George Smith and David Jones. Just change nothing else, but just give me like the names that are more familiar to me that I can tell apart.
Well, it adds to it that they go by like seven different things. Like when you read Anna Karenina, one guy's got seven different names depending on who he's talking to.
Right,
that
right.
doesn't help. But anyway, that was a digression, a parenthetical.
But it's still confirming, like the names are important. My example was that it's important because they're, you know, they're tricky for me because it's not my language and it's a stumbling block. But I do think that, you know, yeah, names are.
So when you run across a name like that in a book like Jane Eyre and you say, okay, Brocklehurst sounds harsh and Temple sounds holy. Is that meant to be, you know, a Bunyan-esque allegorical thing, or is it meant to be a hint or a clue or a foreshadowing for us as readers, something to latch onto? How do you think Charlotte Bronte and writers of that era would approach something like that?
Yeah, I mean, so they would, I mean, clearly there are too many names in this novel that fit the places or the characters to be just coincidental.
Right,
But they're not straightforward symbols or allegories. So again, we see this sort of this dialectical process where, you know, there's an influence and it's softened and smooth and developed, but the influence is still there. Even Jane, you know, Jane is plain, right? I mean, she's... Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, Eliza or Georgiana. She's Jane.
Jane Eyre.
And even, yeah. You can't.
Just kind of, even Elizabeth Bennet, Lizzie Bennet's like, right. You know. Heidi, I think you had something on the tip of your tongue a minute ago. Do you remember what it was? Did it float off into the Mexican ether where you are right now?
All right. I am on spring break in Mexico. I'd make a tequila joke, but I'm afraid it'll be taken seriously. So,
or just the wrong way.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't remember what I was going to say. And it was probably just a less well said version of what Karen said. So
should we make a tequila joke about you forgetting what you were going to say now? Or
maybe so. This is what I mean. Like, yeah. And then that's how rumors get started.
Next thing you know, it's on Twitter.
Right. No one has empathy or sympathy.
Yeah. Karen's having to defend herself for coming on the podcast.
I'm not drinking tequila, people. It's not like I never have, but yeah, exactly. It's noon right now. Yeah. And yes.
it's water. Yes. Well, we've been going for pretty much our allotted amount of time. So Karen and Heidi, as we go into chapters 6 through 11, which is what we've scheduled out for the next episode, what would you recommend people be looking for? What are some of the things you're excited about rereading, or the things that you love about this next section? Anything that comes to mind in particular? Heidi, do you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah. So as I said before, Jane is, I mean, there's many, many things that characterize Jane as a character. And one of them, and the one I'm probably the most interested in, although I just love everything about Jane, is this constant tension that she has between, it's the image of her walking and staring out the window.
Yeah.
And this continual tension, and none of our long-term listeners are going to be surprised by what I'm about to say, but within the soul of this passionate person, this continual tension that's created by duty and desire, right? Like, what is it that she wants versus what she must do? Like, what ought she to do and what does she want to do? And the way that this passionate soul encounters that tension, both in her interior life and in her external life, is the reason why I love this novel so much. Mm. And her like wholehearted engagement with that is like just so compelling to me. And I think that these first chapters, the story of her, if this is a Bildungsroman, then there's always a purpose to the stories that she tells, right? And I think one of the clues for unlocking some of the treasures of this novel is to think, what are we learning about this young woman as she goes through these very intense experiences as an unloved child? And how does she become the kind of person that can encounter that tension between duty and desire without a loving upbringing? And I think that that's very, very compelling kind of contemplation for unlocking this novel.
Mm. Karen, what about you?
So I'll just go in a little bit different direction just for something different to look for. And that would be just the way that the novel uses all these romantic and gothic elements. You know, I mean, like the school is like so horrible, it defies believability, although it was based on a real school that the Bronte girls went to. So some of the things might seem over the top or melodramatic or maudlin or gothic as we go along, yet, and they are, but this is Bronte's genius, that interior life and Jane's response as a character is very realistic. So it tempers those things. She's responding in a way that seems real and seems like someone that we would act, that we might know or want to know. And so I think that's the tension to pay attention to, because some people get, they don't like this book because they're looking at the surface level of things that are sort of like unbelievable, but get beneath that and look at how, this very realistic, authentic character and voice are developed within that context.
I appreciated how in your introduction, I think maybe very early in it, you talked about how at the time, some people thought, this could never happen. And they gave it a bad review. And some people thought, this is way too realistic. And so at the same time, you had both these things, her being accused of falling short in both of these areas at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, from the beginning of the reputation and the reception of the novel has hardly changed at all in that regard.
So then you mentioned that we might now think of it as melodramatic, some of these more gothic elements. Mm-hmm. At the time, would the reader of 1847 have thought of it as melody? Would that be?
Depending on who won what. Yeah, I mean, so there were critics, the sort of established literary writers and critics who were like translating Homer and writing in heroic couplets and, writing fine satire would not have appreciated the sort of feminine, melodramatic, gothic romance. So the tensions that we still have today between high art and low art, feminine literature and masculine literature, all those things existed then as well. Hmm.
Okay, my last question here is, I was actually wondering, so 1847 in England, 1848 in America. How did this book play in America when it came out? I mean, in other words, was it popular? Did people respond to it the same way?
I don't study that. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm just curious if anything came up. All right, well, I guess that's it then. We'll just end on a question that neither of you can answer.
Somebody Google it for next week.
Yeah. So as I said, we'll be discussing chapters 6 through 11, and then we'll basically do roughly 4 chapters after that. I think it's 4 chapters every episode from then on. Karen, I do want to ask you one more thing before we go, if you've got a second. Yeah. As you were working on this and you were doing the notes and you're doing the introduction and you're studying this book really closely, was there anything that surprised you in that process? Something you didn't know about Jane Eyre or Charlotte Bronte, or that you hadn't noticed in reading the book, or even
I love that question.
Definition has changed over time, or something like that.
Oh no! This could take another hour, but no, I will just say, I mean, when I teach works like this, I'm focusing more on the text and then the sort of literary and historical context. So I don't go deeply into an author's life, before I teach it. So for all of these introductions, I've read biographies and had to just dive more deeply into their lives. And so I didn't know about the letter to Robert Southey and that just the rejection and all of those things about her early aspirations as a writer and the boldness, I guess, in writing to the poet laureate. And so all of that was new to me. And I enjoyed that so much. I enjoyed just reading about her life and then having to figure out what to include and what not to. But
right. Yeah. Yeah. Can't say everything.
Right. It's not a biography.
Right. No. Yeah. Well, as we go, please let us know. Please point out things that you learned or, things that are going to help us along the way. I know you will. I mean, that's why you're here, but we've talked about it. It's a great version. It's some of the definitions of words that there's every now and then there was a word, there was, I think even in this section, there was one or two words that I could have got it from the context, but I didn't remember reading that word before. And so having the definition there was, wrote it down.
That part is fun for me. I enjoy that. And having taught, I kind of have a sense from teaching these works, like when students don't know what something is and I know they don't look things up anymore. And so, which is fine. But I mean, it's fine.
Dictionary in their hand and they don't even use it.
So, I'm glad to know that's helpful.
A couple of years ago when I was teaching high school English, I remember reading something and realizing that the kids didn't want to ask, they didn't want to admit they didn't know what a word was. Mm-hmm. And I remember trying to say to them, no, when you don't know, that's like an opportunity. That's fun when you discover a new word. You don't have to be ashamed that you don't know something.
Right.
Even if you're well-read, the instinct is like, oh, I didn't know it. Maybe there's an instinct to,
I'm always
to not admit it.
Yeah. Words when I'm reading. I love it.
Yeah, there's a lot of words out there and they're constantly changing and that's part of the fun of the experience. So, all right. Well, Heidi, any final thoughts from you?
I guess I just want to brag a little that a couple years ago, I'm like obsessed with the Brontes. Like I've read like every biography out there. And then a couple years ago, we were living in Yorkshire for the summer and I got to take my kids to the Bronte house.
Burned it down.
And it was unbelievable. I was like standing in the room where Charlotte Bronte sat at her dining room table and they had like which chair she would sit in to write Jane Eyre and Villette. And you could see the room where like so many of their family members died. And there's this speculation that it was because of something in the water, because there was like there's essentially like a plague in their little town and people just like died from consumption or tuberculosis like all the time. I think that there was a year in which it was like 80% of the population died of tuberculosis because they think now that there was some kind of like infected water supply in the city, which made people more susceptible to it. Their little house really is just like right on the moors. So like there's, and they have it all preserved. You can go see that's the same furniture and everything.
So you can visualize what she's.
Yes. And it has a Bronte museum attached to it. So you can see there. So this is one of those things that if you love the Brontes, people just generally know this, that they were all homeschooled with the exception of having gone away for a short amount of time to this Lowood-like school. And they wrote together these like tiny little books. Like, so they came up with this entire world that they called Gondel, the three sisters and then their brother, who eventually died of alcoholism and complications, health problems from alcoholism. And he was kind of the person that the tenant of Wildfeld Hall, which was Anne Bronte's book. Mm-hmm. She was not as strong of a writer as her sisters, but she was still good. But anyway,
she wasn't as good as two of the greatest writers ever.
Right? Yeah.
odds are.
She wrote kind of an Austen-like book. I don't want to get too far off the subject, but they wrote together as children these like tiny little books about Gondel, and they're little, like 2x2, and written in like the tiniest little handwriting, little childlike handwriting. And you can see these little Gondel books still preserved in glass cases at the Bronte Museum. And then you can go out to their garden and just like out into the moors where they used to just like go wander amongst the heather and like just romp around and come up with stories. And it's just a remarkable. If you ever have an opportunity to do that, you should. But their life was very gothic. Like there was a lot of death, there was a lot of darkness, there was a lot of disease. There was a lot of kind of like religious pressure that was sometimes led to good things and sometimes just too much. And so they had a life that was not unrealistic, but it was very gothic. You can see where they get these ideas of like all these things at stake in their writing. So anyway, sorry, that was just my waxing eloquently on the life of the Brontes for a minute.
And your experiences, you're bragging about you getting to go.
Although it wasn't eloquent, it was kind of stumbling, but it's because I love them so much.
Waxing affectionate.
There you go. Not much more affectionate than eloquent. So.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining us. This is going to be really fun. Thanks for doing the book. As I said, I've really enjoyed this reading through of it. And I'm excited to dig into it in a way that I haven't done in years. So it's going to be a good time. I'm going to start journaling my way through this book because I'm noticing like I really am. I have way more affection for the book reading it this time than I had before. And it's fun when you rediscover a book that you had I didn't dislike it. I just didn't. Mm-hmm.
The gothic genre is not your fave.
No, it's not. So, yeah. but this character is so specific and so interesting and so compelling that I all overlook the gothic stuff.
there you go.
I'm just kidding. All right, well, For Karen Swalla Pryor and for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Till next time, happy reading.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.